Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison, d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Patricia Pena is Canada's ambassador to Chile. Not only is this her first HOM posting, it is her first posting period, as she's a relatively recent entrant to the Canadian Public Service. Patricia stopped by my office recently to talk about how her family first came to Canada from Spain, the importance of asking for what you want, taking risks, and going with your gut, and how life is going with three children and a trailing spouse down in Chile. Hey, Patricia, thanks for coming by. You're currently our HOM in Chile, one of Canada's closest friends in the region, land of great red wine. I want to talk to you all about that. But I actually want to start at the beginning, because I only recently learned that you are a relatively recent entrant to the public service. Only a decade ago, you're already ambassador in Chile, but you're the child of Spanish immigrants. When did your parents come to Canada and why?
Hi, David. It's funny, my identity as an immigrant, I only really started crafting it as I became ambassador. When you leave your country, that you kind of have to start your story, and I just thought of myself as a Canadian. My parents, well, they actually met here.
Okay.
So my mother left Spain as a 10-year-old with her family for political reasons. Life under Franco was a bit difficult, so they sought a better life. Middle-class family, but looking for something different. So she came when she was 10, moved to Toronto. She probably bore more of the brunt of what it's like to come as a young immigrant. My father, economic migrant. Left after he finished his high school, went to Germany because that's where he could get a job, did the whole lottery system, really wanted to go to Australia, but his ticket came up for Canada. And so he landed in Toronto one day, and after a few years they met, and I had the privilege to be, you know, the first member of my family, and as far as our family tree can tell, to be born outside of Spain and born in Canada.
Where did they meet? They met just randomly in Toronto? Or were they part of, I guess my question is, were they part of a diaspora community, or did they see themselves almost instantly as Canadian and they just met as two young Canadians?
My father lodged with a German family because he didn't actually speak English. He spoke German at the time, and so they themselves were immigrants. So he stayed with them for, I guess, a while. I'm not quite sure how long. And my grandparents, in order to make ends meet, you know, they emigrated a bit later in life, having had their family after the Spanish Civil War, and my grandmother ran like a boarding house. So when, you know, Spaniards came, it was kind of a bit of a stopping point.
Right.
And my mom jokes, you know, she had gone to a wedding and met this young guy who was a bit annoying. She gets home from school one day and he's sitting in her kitchen. So he ended up being a boarder. Now, I'm not recommending that as a way to meet necessarily your future partner, but it worked in this instance.
So, okay.
But that's also it points to the paths that people take when they're kind of moving to a new country.
And, right.
And, you know, sometimes it isn't obvious, and those stopping points of, you know, other people have made the path before you, and, you know, whether
sure.
it's rooming houses or offering a job to someone, that kind of creates a bit of a community.
Right. So that's a good segue to your own departure from Canada. You were born in Toronto, you went to U of T, and then you went over to the UK, to the London School of Economics, and for reasons I don't know, you stayed. And I'm wondering, given your parents' story, whether that had to do with your husband.
Yeah. So, yeah, I studied at U of T, you know, modest family with modest means and great university in your town, so why would I go anywhere else? I felt hugely privileged. I did go away for my third year, and so got a little bit of a taste for what it was like to go abroad. I you know, when people talk about the benefits of an international education, I mean, I felt that.
Wow.
So I went to France, and there was an exchange program between Ontario and the Rhône-Alpes region of France.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied. I thought, well, I have nothing to lose. And I got to spend a year there. And it really, you know, the education was great, but it was more the experience of living in a totally different context. And, you know, people throw out words like intercultural awareness. I, you know, lived it as a 20-year-old. What is it like to actually have to go and figure out how you're going to buy toothpaste in a country where you're not quite sure how pharmacies work, or where do you buy toothpaste in this country?
Et en ce moment-là, t'as déjà parlé français ou le but était d'apprendre le français?
Donc, je parlais déjà un petit peu le français. J'ai fait de l'éducation en immersion à Toronto.
Okay.
C'est qu'à Toronto, il n'y avait pas beaucoup de monde qui parlait français. Mais j'étais vraiment francophile. À l'université, je me suis rendu compte, j'étais à l'université de Toronto, puis je me suis rendu compte que, bon, il fallait travailler pendant l'été, gagner des sous. Puis le ministère d'éducation d'Ontario, il y avait une partie langue anglaise, puis une partie langue française. Du côté français, ils payaient $1 de plus de l'heure. Donc je me suis dit, je vais payer du côté langue française, mais j'ai toujours été très francophile.
Ouais.
Je parle espagnol, donc ça m'a aidé un petit peu.
Ouais.
J'ai pas étudié le français en France. J'ai étudié la politique et tout ça, mais
okay.
bien sûr, j'ai beaucoup, beaucoup appris.
Ouais.
Et je suis revenue avec un accent vraiment mélangé, franco-canadien, français.
Mais alors, francophile, but you decided on graduate school.
You know, actually, that was a funny story, and it taught me a lot about... advocating for yourself. So I actually applied for a few different graduate schools. I applied for scholarships because I, you know, I had to find a way to be able to finance this. I didn't have, you know, any savings. So I actually applied for a scholarship at the University of Birmingham, and it was a very generous one. And I had also applied to the London School of Economics. And I got the one in Birmingham, and I got an entrance to the LSE, but I actually was a bit bold. I, you know, I guess in common language, maybe I leaned in.
Yeah.
and I wrote back to the LSE and I said, I'd love to go to your school. However, I've got this great scholarship from Birmingham.
Right.
Can you do something for me? I mean, I'm sure I wrote it much more nicely. And surprisingly, they came back. And 2 weeks before leaving, I changed my mind.
There's a refrain that has come up a couple times in this podcast, which is you don't get what you don't ask for. So, and I guess, as you say in modern parlance, that's lean in. Anyhow, you went and you stayed, and you ended up with a career or a good stretch in local government.
So the idea was to go do a 9-month master's at this amazing school, and it was fantastic. And I went there with my boyfriend at the time, now my husband. You know, we were around this university context, and he said, you know, I think I might want to do a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd come over from Canada together, and he started a PhD. So then I said to myself, well, I've got to find myself a job.
And is he also Spanish?
There aren't that many Spaniards in Canada. Just putting that on the table. but we met through a common friend. So I've been jokingly asked, was it an arranged marriage? No, because if it was, he would be from the same region that I'm family's from in Spain.
Right.
He's from a totally different area. They speak a different language. But yeah, we were just...
Right.
It worked.
Good.
So he did a PhD, and then I had to find some work.
So you worked for a long stretch in the UK, and then my understanding is you came back to Canada and into Canadian government in the RPL program, the Recruitment of Policy Leaders. Talk to me about that, and for listeners, this is a mid-career or early mid-career high flyer type program designed to bring people into government for the first time. And many of the successful applicants have actually studied or worked abroad. So it is, my assumption is it's by design trying to get new blood, new ideas into the Canadian policy, the federal policymaking system. But I've always found it a bit of a strange mix with foreign affairs because you don't come in as rotational, but you came to CETA. Why?
You know, when you come back, and I thought to myself, I've always done public service. That's actually probably one of the uniting threads in my background, whether it was working at the Ministry of Education in Ontario as a summer student, going to the UK and having to make a choice. I had a job offer at Mars, the chocolate company. It was kind of fun. They had a graduate program. I thought, oh, this is kind of neat. And then I got the offer from what eventually came the Electoral Commission, so equivalent to Elections Canada. And I just have always gone with my gut. It felt right to go the public service side. So I came back here and I thought, this is great. You know, I have something to offer. I've done public service in other countries and other spaces. I should be able to do this in Ottawa for my own government. And it was, you know, it was remarkably hard to find an entry point that didn't require me to take on a student entry job. I had 10 years of experience.
Right.
So this policy leaders program was really like one of my only options other than taking on temporary work, which, you know, I kind of felt like I should be able to come in. Not entitled, but I had enough to offer.
Yeah, you felt you could.
The amount of jobs that there are in this government, there should be a space for me somewhere.
And you came in at the director level.
No, I didn't actually. So I had, I mean, and it was a bit of a leap of faith because I had a very senior job in the UK. I was overseeing all of the political financing in the whole country for elections. And I came in as a, what was at the time, an EC6, so a policy analyst. But, you know, I had faith.
Right.
I really wanted to participate. And I said, okay, well, I'll take this as a starting point. If it doesn't work out, then I'll look at something else. But it felt right. So I entered development agency, which I had never done any development.
But do you consider yourself a risk taker? You know, there are lots of criticisms of the public service and of public servants as not taking enough risks. You did. But I'm wondering whether you think of yourself like that.
I think so. I think I am more comfortable with trying to do things differently, but they're qualified risks. Like, I'm taking the risk because I actually think that not doing anything is worse.
Right. Not doing anything is a choice as well.
Yeah, one of the things that we have to do better, and one of my personal kind of interests, is measuring the opportunity cost of what we're doing. And that's, you know, when you decide to sit, that is actually a cost, but we're not very good at evaluating that. Whereas stepping out, you know, on an edge, or questioning a rule or trying to push the boundaries of something, you know, it's not comfortable, but it's the right thing to do sometimes, and I'm willing to take the responsibility, but, you know, it doesn't always work. Sometimes I have to step back from the ledge and get in cover myself in a blanket.
But it seems to have worked for you because you were at CETA when I arrived in 2012. You had a very strong reputation despite having only a couple years before then, never had any experience in international development. Talk to me about your time at CETA and what you brought with you into the amalgamation in 2013.
So I came into CETA with a firm kind of belief in the importance of democratic governance, human rights issues, transparency and inclusion. These are things that I had done in my job in the UK, but were also personal interests from my studies. And I was able to continue these. I mean, for me, CETA was this world of learning and experience, people so committed to what they're doing that it was, you know, I wanted to come to work every day. So maybe I hadn't studied it before, maybe I hadn't worked in the field, but I felt that there was a link there. And it was a great place to work. And I would say that culture is what really kind of sealed the deal for me to join. I felt it immediately, that this is a place where I can be a contributor, but also come in as a manager. And I would say I've been given a lot of opportunities, but I've really tried to focus on being a good manager with and for people. And that's one of the things that I think you can carry with you regardless of what you're doing.
So let's probe that a bit. C'est quoi un bon manager? What is the Patricia Peña philosophy of being a good manager? Because everybody wants to be that, but and you certainly have that reputation, but what's your secret?
I don't think there is a secret. I'm always trying to, let me see, I try and listen better. It's something that I've had to work at, because usually the clues are out there and ideas are out there, I try and focus on how can I work through people. So not do things myself, but get others to either join an idea or empower them to deliver it. I try and build teams that are varied. I'm very conscious of the fact that your natural tendency is to associate yourselves with those that are just like you.
Right.
And I've deliberately tried to, you know, and without being stereotypical, you know, the loud one and the quiet one, you know, make sure you can kind of build teams around that.
Phyllis Yaffe, who's our consul general in New York, told me at one point that if you're, you know, spending time with, if you're a leader and you're spending time with people that agree with you, you're not doing your job. So there really is something to be said for diverse viewpoints. But still, as leaders in the public sector, actually getting the best out of people is a real art, which is why I agree with you when you say it's there's no simple answer to the question that I was trying to ask you. So you worked at CETA in a number of capacities. You, like many of us, came across the river at the time of the amalgamation from the CETA headquarters to 125 Sussex. At that time, did you realize that a new vista was opening up to you in terms of foreign postings?
The amalgamation, I call it the 6 months of baptism of fire, because the team that I had been working with was mixed in with a whole new team that really was this example of what it meant to, you know, the French, I like the French term fusion, you know, this fusion of different works. So we had people that came from what was quote unquote traditional foreign policy work. We had a few people who'd worked on trade issues. And then we had a team that had been working on development. And day one, they actually had to geographically be sitting beside one another. These people had never worked together.
Right.
And this was in the M branch, which went from being purely multilateral at CETA to doing a whole number of things at Global Affairs.
So it was a time of great uncertainty, and you realize people adapt and face change
in different,
very different ways. And it was very hard for some people. So we talked about it a lot. I tried to set up a bit more of an open space. So not the kind of cubicle culture in the same way, and build camaraderie. So a lot of it, and frankly, I think at the beginning, some people thought we were just, you know, doing a whole bunch of things. We're wasting their time and diverting them from the real work.
Sure.
But building up that kind of that culture of working together and interaction, I think really helped out. So it was quite good. I think, you know, a team of 40 people, about a third coming from different spaces. And within a year we had, you know, we got a mojo. And, you know, there was this one moment where I found myself in Washington at a meeting of the World Bank, where I was sitting on a meeting on climate change, and where I looked at my notes, and it was this aha moment where in two lines it talked about the pressing geopolitical challenges of climate change, the impact on people living in developing countries.
So you worked in the same capacity for 3 or 4 years. So you really saw it through, and then you put your name forward to be a head of mission. And listeners can't see, but Patricia's smiling at me, because that was a pretty big jump. You have told me that it just wasn't on the radar screen, not because you didn't want to be ahead of mission, but there's a lifestyle choice that you make and that you make your family make in a certain sense. So talk to me about that. I mean, I had my postings, I think, are mostly behind me, because if I suggested it, I think my children would mutiny. You have 3 girls. All of a sudden, they're at the other end of the hemisphere in English or French or Spanish-speaking schools. Anyhow, a huge decision for you guys as a family last summer. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I met colleagues that say, you know, all I've ever wanted to do was be in the Foreign Service. I've never had that idea of pursuing a particular job. but I've always had an international orientation. Whether it's studying abroad, part of my academic studies were kind of looking at international issues, traveling. So there's always this other thread, which was kind of international. And, you know, when I reflect on what I've done for the last 4 years before going out, I mean, it was diplomacy. We didn't talk about it that way. I'd go to negotiating tables. I'd sit beside all these other countries. There'd be a flag in front of me. And
yeah.
I'd press the buzzer and I'd speak and deliver speeches. And so I was doing diplomacy, but not with this title of ambassador.
Right.
So making it work for my family. I mean, I've got three kids. Two are teenagers. One is younger, seven. And I think they always knew it was on the radar. So I had kind of laid the little seeds for doing this, but making it work at this point in time.
Right.
And I couldn't share information with them until
sure.
it was happening. So, you know, it's been, I have to say, you know, they were willing to go for it.
Right.
They complained.
And they missed their
my friends.
Yeah.
It's the unknown.
Yeah.
And also for my husband, my partner.
Right.
You know, we're a great family that works. Because we're both working.
Yeah.
Now, is he on leave or?
He's the reason we came back to Canada. He's a professor at Carleton, and he's actually been able to continue working, which is pretty amazing. Studies are changing in university; a lot more courses online,
right.
And so he put his hand up to teach online courses. And so, as far as his students are concerned, they don't know where he is.
Right.
It's an exciting time for him too, because we get to, you know, do this adventure together, but also for him professionally, learning a different way of being a university professor. So he's just finished his first course, and I think it's gone pretty well. It's a bit of a rush to kind of change things and then figure out a new way of viewing his work, but also stepping into this role of being the spouse of an ambassador.
So I'm interested in that, because in a certain sense, your whole family gig has changed. I was down in Santiago at some point earlier this year, and Patricia was kind enough to host a lunch or a dinner for me at the residence. And one is always conscious at such times that I, you know, kids are somewhere and your husband is somewhere, and you know, one feels ever so slightly one's intruding on your family life, but you carried it off with great aplomb, as if you'd been doing it forever. But like, how does that work in a family sense when you have the likes of me and other strangers, frankly, traipsing through your living room and dining room?
I think it's been helped by the fact that before we went, I put all the cards on the table. And I said, this is what it's going to be like. You're going to live in a house that's a working house. We already were quite social as a family, so the idea of having big dinners didn't come as a surprise. The fact that they don't have a seat at the table always is perhaps the bigger surprise.
Do they get the leftovers?
They get nice leftovers. So I think they're okay. They wouldn't have dessert every day.
Yeah.
Otherwise. And actually, it's funny that you should mention that, because during that dinner, which I think, you know, was really great, it's part of what I'm doing regularly. So my husband did a Skype call with one of his students in a room somewhere else.
Right.
The kids came back from soccer, so a bit of carpooling going on. They had their dinner. But then after everyone left, we had a bit of a get-together ourselves and just kind of finished the day with a bit of a chat. And you have to be flexible. You know, there's some good days and there's some not-so-great days.
Right.
I think that some of those might be due to the fact that I just have teenagers.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, they are due to the fact that there's been so much change. And that's when I have to say to myself, okay, you know what? I'm going to not attend something for the next day, and I'm just going to focus. It's part of my own well-being. It's part of their well-being. Just chilling out a little.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds a lot like family life in Ottawa sometimes with the challenges. You get to work in the capital city of a country which is one of Canada's closest partners. You new government there, like-minded with Canada in almost all ways. What have been the challenges? I mean, when things are going so well between the two countries and you're the rep, is it all sort of milk and honey? Or What do you struggle with in the professional side of what you're doing?
I mean, the timing of my arrival as ambassador was, I think, very interesting because you were sort of saying goodbye to an existing government, but then also finishing up initiatives. And then you're really looking ahead to see, okay, this is great. There's this new team. We have this great relationship. How do we make sure we keep it great? And I think that's sometimes more challenging because the initial reaction for people can be, oh, Chile, that's all great. That's all that's all good.
Yeah.
You're fine. And then they turn their attention to something else more pressing. So I think one of the challenges is keeping the attention. There's a lot of enthusiasm. I worry about over-promising, under-delivering. On the part of the bilateral relationship, you know, there's so many tangents, you know, and not to name specifics, but it's very diverse. You know, we've got fisheries with a government that is still figuring out its plans and priorities, that's shooting on all cylinders,
right,
but you can't deliver on all of those. So I think one of my initial challenges is how do you stay focused? How do you find those best areas where you can both work together in the most effective way? I find the government very open. I can, you know, there's good relationships with Canada, good understanding of Canada, and they're looking forward to hosting APEC.
Yes.
Which, you know, that's in a year and a half's time. So now we're May 2018. By the end of this year, so the end of 2018, they'll be hosting their first meetings and leading up to a full year of what is an Asia-Pacific-oriented
right.
Global discussion on a variety of themes, and I can see they're looking there and I'm looking there too.
Right.
So that's my second challenge.
Okay, so great days ahead, Patricia. We'll follow that closely. Peru did the same thing this year, so that coast of Latin America is certainly looking to Asia, and I know you'll be right there with them. This has been terrific. Thanks for coming by. You have told listeners that you've leaned in and you've asked when you thought it appropriate. You've said to go with your gut, and you've said that sometimes you have to have a little faith. And those all certainly strike me as words to live by. So thanks for coming by, and all the best.
Thanks so much, David. This was actually a lot of fun.
Okay, bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.